Hello, everyone. My name is Lisa Lowe, and I am an alcoholic. And if you would just indulge me for a minute, I want to just make sure that I don't go too much over time here. And I'd like to, if you don't mind, just start out with a little prayer out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It grounds me, and it reminds me to set aside. This is the set-aside prayer, and it goes like this. God, please help me set aside everything I think I know about myself, the 12 steps, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the meetings, my disease, and of you, God. So I may have an open mind and a new experience with all of these things. Please let me see the truth. So, like I said, my name is Lisa Lowe. And I am an alcoholic, and I can you can already tell that I'm not a Southern belle. I have a little bit of an accent. So my sobriety date is June 15th, 1993. I got sober when I was 4 years old. It was a very difficult detox. I got sober in Philadelphia. And I'm just going to qualify myself about what it was like for me and what it's like now. And when I got sober, okay, I did not have any kind of treatment or that kind of stuff. Okay, it just wasn't available to me. So in Philadelphia, where I grew up in this middle town, middle class kind of area. And in my home, it sort of was like Grace Kelly married Jimmy Hoffa. Okay, that's how it was. That was my mom. That was my dad. So you can imagine the turmoil, right? I got a dad downstairs that's like sneaking, doing the numbers. And I got a mother upstairs who's very Irish, Lily Lacey type of mother. And they had five children. They had four boys, and then I was the youngest and the only girl. So they had five children. And my father was an alcoholic. He drank, and he was probably one of the best men that I have ever known. But he was a drunk, and their relationship was an absolute train wreck. And my mother, who did not go to Al-Anon, stayed married to him for 52 years. So there's a lot of, you know, there was a lot of animosity in my home. And I believe that I'm Irish, right? So I'm 100% Irish, CIA, Catholic Irish alcoholic, right? And so I believe that this is not in the book. This is just my perception, is that I already got the gene. If you look at my lineage, we're all drunks. Okay? Left side, right side, we're all drunks. So I already have the gene. But then you throw me in this type of environment, right? It's like Chia Pet. Right? Throw some Jack Daniels on me and whoop. Instant alcoholic. I only need like one little thing of water, right? A little Jack Daniels on it, and I'm off to the races. When I was 9 years old, my Uncle Frank had died. And I remember distinctly going to, now if you're Irish, if you're not Irish, then this is how it's usually done. But if you're Irish, you know the deal, right? So, you know, what's the difference between an Irish marriage and an Irish funeral? One person. So when I went to his funeral, I was 9 years old, and I remember my mother holding my hand. And when we were going up to the funeral pyre, Irish people have an open casket if you're Catholic, right? So, and I remember walking up, and I remember my mother being so uncomfortable, and she was like almost humiliated because my father and my uncle Ed were handing out silo cups out of the back of the Pontiac, the silver Pontiac he had. And they had like a half a keg. And while we were going up to my Uncle Frank's, you know, they were handing out booze, beers. And so you could go in, you could have a drink, you could pay your respects and out you go. And I remember my mother being like so appalled. And when I got up to his coffin, it was outlined with like Taylor Mardu and Seagram 7. And I mean, they put booze, like you think the Egyptians. They want to make sure you got enough booze for the afterlife, the Irish people. Because they literally lined his coffin. And I remember my mother being like, oh, she hated every part of it. We left there. That was at the age of 9. Now, little did I know, at the age of 11, I would pick up my first drink. And I picked up my first drink with my next-door neighbor, and we drank Black Label beer. And from that moment, from the age of 11, I blacked out from that moment. Now, if you do any kind of studies, you'll find out that your brain doesn't even fully develop until you're 25 years old. So at the age of 11, I'm drinking Black Label beer in Mrs. Karen Jelly's basement, right? And I'm doing everything and anything to get out of the house that I'm in. Now, if you look on the outside of my house, people are like, oh, yeah, that family's great, blah, blah, blah. But the inside was quite the nightmare. Now, it was like walking on eggshells my entire life. Now, I don't know that I'm walking on eggshells. I'm 9. I'm 11. Okay? This is natural for me, right? But as far back as I can remember, I'm always like this. Right? I'm always on the alert. So I don't know. I think everybody's on the alert. And I'm never quite as comfortable as like my friends are in their houses. And I never want anybody really come over my house because nothing's really happening, but there's this, when you walk in, this feeling of anxiety all the time, right? So I start drinking at the age of 11. I black out, and when you hear about like all the new age stuff now, the new age spirituality about like being in the now, and Eckhart Tolle writes a book called Being in the Now, and just, you know, being present and all that. Like, you throw some Jack Daniels in me and I'm present. I'm 100% in the now right now. Cause all that anxiety went away. And I'm doing some, you know, some Sambuca. I'm 11. I'm doing shots of Buca and I'm doing Black Label beer and I'm like, where's the party? And I'm 11. Okay? And I'm 100% in the now. I'm not worried about going home. I'm not worried about any of that stuff. And I start blacking out that early. And I'd like to give you this big story of like what the progression of alcoholism did to me. But honestly, as a young child, I don't remember. I drank. I didn't stop drinking until I was 26. So all of that time, like I remember like trying to go to university, trying to go to school, trying to accomplish things, and whatever I did, I could never, ever finish. I really tried, but I could never finish. And I always felt that there was something wrong. I just didn't know what the hell it was. Now, my brothers were drinking as much as I was drinking. So in my network of people, we drank. That's what we did. It wasn't, matter of fact, if you didn't drink, I didn't trust you. Something's wrong with you. Right? You remember thinking like that? Like, oh, they don't drink. Oh, goody two-shoes over there. I don't want to hang out with them. Can't trust them. So my whole world is completely skewed. So by the time that I reach my bottom, okay, now, I'm sure you all know, and in your own stories, have felt and witnessed the delusion of alcoholism and the stories that you can tell yourself to make it okay, right? So I'm just going to tell you this one story. This is like maybe, I don't know, a couple years before I got sober, maybe 2 years before I got sober, but I was engaged a couple times. But I was engaged to this one gentleman, and we were supposed to get married, and he should have been in Al-Anon, right? Because he found me wherever I went. They find us, Cliff, they find us. And he found me in this bar, and he's like, listen, you got to, you know, dragging me out of the bar. I'm like, why are you down here? You know, the whole nine yards, right? And he got a brand new, this is how many years ago, a brand new Ford Probe when they first came out. And I got in the car, and we're driving down 95, and I'm completely wasted. And I get the thought, I need to teach him a lesson. That's the thought. So out of complete spontaneity, I take the steering wheel going 60 miles an hour, and I pull it all the way to the right, and the two of us go smashing into the guardrail. And I broke my femur, really, really bad accident. Broke my femur, put him out of, in traction, the whole nine yards. The minute I woke up out of that, I was in a coma, not because of my injuries, because my alcohol level was 3.4. So they couldn't even operate on me. They're like, we can't put her out, she'll die. She's already out. We can operate on her. She wouldn't even feel it. So they had to put, rods and stuff in my legs. But the point being that, I put somebody in the hospital, and I woke up out of that, and the first things out of my mouth was, I wasn't driving. The first thing out of my mouth was, I wasn't driving, and I blamed it all on him. And I knew that I was lying, and I let that go. I didn't care. And I got out, and they went back to my mom's house. Big long story. Now they put me into the basement because they were afraid of fire. I have this cast up to my hip. I broke my femur in two places, blah, 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 right? Okay, so he's not having nothing to do with me. My girlfriend Janet is coming down to help me with the bedpan. I'm getting Percocets from the doctor. I'm eating them like crazy, blah, blah, blah. 6 months down the road, I'm ready to go out. Now, I traded in my plastic cast, my plaster of Paris cast when they used to do that, and then now they put this Velcro cast on, and now I'm able to walk with a walker, and I get the great idea of, you know what? I could get a lot of free drinks with this leg. Like, only an alcoholic thinks like this. So I call my girlfriend Jan, and I'm like, Jan, listen, you got to come down, pick me up, blah, 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 blah. We got to go to the AD Club on Frankfurt Avenue in Philadelphia. So that's what we do. And I meet some guy there. Shocker. I meet some guy there. I get into his car, and he's going to take me home. And we get into a car accident. And I still have my plastic cast on my left leg. I fractured, very minor fracture, my tibia and fibia of my right leg. But the same rescue squad came. This is a true story. I am not making this one up. Same rescue squad came, but I was so out of it. When they put me into the rescue squad, they took me to Frankfurt Torresdale. The same emergency room orthopedic surgeon doctor was on call. The same, took one look at me and said, give her a blood alcohol test. We're not going to be able to touch her. And in my stupor, with my cast, the other one like half hanging off, I remember they had to like bolt me down, put me down on the gurney, and leaning up, going, I didn't like what you did with my left leg. I want a new doctor anyway. Like, this is a true story. Like, I didn't like your services. And I called her eyelashes. Eyelashes, Two years go by. Now, after this happens, I'm drinking in the hospital, and I'm doing other substances because I can. Right? I have a Dilaudid drip. I'm tick, 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 tick. And I'm calling Janet. Janet! and get the beers. Come on, how can we get this ordered for you too? You know, I'm trying to figure out how I can get a chair with Janet out of the door. Like, you want to talk about total insanity. And let me tell you something. This was all completely normal to me. Completely normal. I remember one specific time before my mother asked me to leave her house. There was a gentleman right across the street. His name was Mr. Miller. And he had a beautiful wife and these two beautiful kids. And I remember I was really hungover Easter morning. And I'm looking out the window and they're coming out in their little baskets. And the girls had these little, you know, Easter, the dresses and everything on. And I remember distinctly, I can still see it now as I speak to you, looking out the window and thinking, poor Mr. Miller, man, I got to go over and take him out. And I used to call children anchors. That's what I used to call them. Him and his poor anchors. He's got those anchors front. My God. I don't know how he does it. I was feeling sorry for Mr. Miller because he had a family that he was going. Like, to me, that was like death. Like, oh my God, responsibility and marriage and, oh, my like, that's how saturated my brain was with alcohol. So I'm going to speed up. 2 years go by. Now, the last 3 months of my drinking, I'm going to girlfriend's house, I'm couch surfing. And then, you know, I don't know if you guys have ever experienced doing the couch surfing thing, and then you get the eyeball from, like, the husband. I hear a laugh. You get the eyeball, like, you gotta leave now. And you're like, oh, I gotta find another place to stay. So you leave that couch and you go. So I ran out of my couch surfing ideas and I figure, this is a brilliant idea. I know what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna go live in the woods like a bohemian because I'm gonna now wash my hair in the creek with the fresh vitamins and the beautiful natural. And I'm going to be like a bird watcher. And I'm going to wear long skirts and be like Stevie Nicks. And I'm like, I'm not going to have a job because jobs are for suckers. And I'm going to break into people's homes when they go to work. And then I could, you know, eat their food and wash and get a shower and have a ham and cheese sandwich and watch a Days of Our Lives. I'm brilliant. I'm brilliant. Like, I don't know, I gotta keep this to myself, people steal my idea. And that's what I started to do. I started to break in Philadelphia they have these, I got five brothers, they taught me how to hotwire cars, they taught me how to break into houses, I got four alcoholic brothers, right, so I know the tricks. So I learned how to break into these little French doors in row homes in Philly. And that's what I start doing. Now, I'm committing a felony, but I don't consider it a felony. It's not a felony. It would be ridiculous. I'm just borrowing some stuff. But I don't realize that because I'm under the delusion of alcohol and other substances. So one day, I go out with this gentleman, and there was a bar right outside of these woods. It was called the City Line Tavern. It was right by the 66 bus meets Frankfurt Avenue. And this kind of place was the kind of place I know one or two of you have drank. You know, the ones with the bars on the window? Yeah. Where you could buy, you know, a beer and a bag of one-stop shopping. Right? So you could all do all of that in one stop. And it was, you know, they would bet on the cockroaches. That's a true story. They would bet on the cockroaches. Cockroaches running down the bar. They're like, oh, okay. It was like a horse race. And I go in there, and now it's like 5 o'clock in the morning, but they're not open. So at 6 o'clock, I know that they're open. So I slump myself on the side of this bar, right? And I'm homeless now, but I don't know I'm homeless. I pretend I'm a bohemian. Okay, so I don't know if any of you have been under the delusion of alcoholism. Okay, so now I'm slumped up against the City Line bar, And this gentleman, his name is Joe Brown, God rest his soul. He was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous for 40, I don't even know how many years. He had a Philadelphia Inquirer stand right next to the City Line Bar. And he got that stand because he used to sell papers there and make a living. He used to 12-step drunks. So I'm slumped up now, and I got, you know, the outfit on, and I'm, you know, I got three fingernails, and the stockings are all ripped up, and 5 o'clock in the morning, and Joe comes up to me, and he says, "Hey, how you doing?" And I thought, he wants me. Do you remember when we thought that? No, you're not. He don't want you, Lisa. But I don't know this, right? I'm like, you know, I'm out for 3 days. I'm like, he wants me. So he came up to me and he's like, "Listen, I'd like to talk to you about your drinking." I'm like, "My drinking? What are you talking about? I'm not talking to you." So I leave. I go back to my woods. Now, I was only living in the woods probably maybe 3 weeks to a month. Honestly, I can't even really remember a time frame. I know it wasn't that long. So the next morning I get up, or it was maybe a couple days later, and I'm waiting for a family to leave so I can break into their houses and eat their food. There was hedges that I was sleeping behind underneath this tree so I could be tucked away. Nobody could see me. So about 8 o'clock in the morning, I go like this with the hedges, like right out of the movies, you know, and I'm looking around. And on the one side, there was this strip mall. And I see these guys, and just a couple of girls, but mostly guys with these styrofoam cups, these styrofoam white cups. And I'm like, who are those weirdos? They're weird, right? I'm like this with the hedges, but they're weird. So I see one of the people catch my eye, and I'm like, you know how paranoid we are when we're out there. Everybody wants to know our business. Nobody cares, Lisa, but I don't know this. So he spots me, and he goes down, walking down the grassy knoll, and I'm like, oh, he's coming for me. And he gets about 10 feet away, and, you know, Cliff was talking last night about the old timers in Alcoholics Anonymous and what they know to say and what they know not to say because of their wisdom and their experience. And he said to me, "Hey, do you remember me?" Now, I didn't know remember him, but it was Joe Brown. And I said, "No." He said, "Well, it doesn't matter. Listen, I just want to let you know, we have some coffee and donuts up here." I was like, "Coffee and donuts? Okay." And then I also looked up and saw there was nothing, 80% men. There were coffee, donuts, and a place to live. Perfect! I hit the jackpot. So I don't even know where I'm going. But this gentleman, you know, reached down. There's a saying in Alcoholics Anonymous that the only time that we look down on another alcoholic is when we reach down and pull them out of the muck and mire in which they are in and help them to find a new way of life. That's the only time that we look down on them. He looked down, he pulled me out of that muck and mire, and I had, for the ladies in the room, maybe some of the gentlemen, you know what candies are? Remember candies? Right? I had candies. I was living in the wood with my candies on. And as I was walking up the grassy knoll, my heels were going whoosh, 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 into the grass. And he looked down and he said to me, "They're really nice shoes." And I was like, "Thank you, he likes my shoes." And I went up to my very first AA meeting that I had no idea I was attending, and I have no recollection of. I walked into that meeting, and he sat me down right in. These two guys were sitting next to me, and Joe said to one of his sponsees, "You want to get her a cup of coffee?" And the sponsee looked at me and said, "Would you like a cup of coffee?" And I said, "Yes, I really would. I would like a cup of coffee." So as he got up to get it, went to the coffee bar to get me a cup of coffee, I actually stood up and said, "Can I have a I like two creams, two sugars, and can you pop that in the microwave for me?" And the entire room said, like, "Keep coming back." And I was like, and the reason I bring that up is because 5 minutes ago I was in the woods, and 10 minutes later I'm already entitled hurry up, do what I want you to do, quick now. That's the entitlement and the arrogance of the alcoholic mind. So he came back with that coffee, and as soon as he came back with that coffee, these two men got up, and two women, and I was like, what is going on here? Why is there two women beside me? And back in the day, I didn't have anywhere to go, so they called when you sat on someone. I'm sure Dick remembers that, when you sit on someone, right? For the old-timers, when they don't have anywhere to go, so, you know, somebody took me for a couple days, and then they passed me off for another woman and let me sleep in her basement for a couple days, and this was going on for about 2 weeks. Now, mind you, I have no idea where I'm at or what I'm doing, but they're feeding me. They're letting me sleep at their homes. They're telling me about AA and drinking. And I'm like, yeah, you got another sandwich? Yeah, you're right. And a cake and coffee. And oh, yeah. And I'm sleeping. I'm like, oh, these people are wonderful. Who are these people? Now, they're telling me who they are, but I am so saturated with alcohol that I don't know. About 2 or 3 weeks into it, they said, listen, you're going to have to find a place to live. So I had to land. I landed up going back to my mother's house. Now, at that point, okay, I didn't want to go back there. And long story short, she said to me, one drink. And I knew she was serious. You're out. So they kept picking me up for meetings. And it just so happened that Frank the Fish, that's what they used to call him, right? Frank the Fish was really good friends with my brother. Well, Frank saw me in a meeting, and he said to me, hey, are you Russell's sister? I said, yeah. He's like, I'm Frankie the Fish. You know, South Philly, Frank the Fish. I'm like, hey, what are you doing here? He's like, listen, you need a ride, because I don't have a car, license of home, nothing. So he would pick me up at 12 o'clock every day, and I would say, Frankie, where are we going? Because I knew Frankie, where are we going? And he'd say, oh, we're going to go play bocce ball. I was like, bocce ball? Yeah, bocce ball. Then I'd land up in an AA meeting. I'm like, what happened to the bocce ball? He's like, oh, no, we're going to play bocce ball after. Then the next day, Frankie, where are we going? Oh, we're going to go get some pizza. I was like, oh, yeah, pizza. We land up in an AA meeting. Like, Frank, what happened to the pizza? It's like, yeah, after. Frank, where are we going? We're going to play tennis. I was like, I don't do tennis. He's like, today you do. And this is how you talk to each other up north. Oh, you don't play tennis? Today you do. Get in the car. Right? I was like, I don't know. Yeah. So, Frank, what happened? I'm in another AA meeting. These were called ARA, my AA kidnappers. And that's what they did. They kidnapped me. They took me to Atlantic City. I was going to meetings in Atlantic City. I was going to Ventnor. I was going to meetings here. I was going to meetings there. I didn't even know. I was just like, Get in the car. I'd say, where are we going? Somewhere. They never were truthful. They never asked me, like, would you like to go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting? No, they never did that. They said, get in the car. That's where we're going. And this is how I got sober. And about 3 weeks into this, I started to sober up, and the peels started to get off of my eyes, and I realized I'm in AA. Oh my God, a month later, I'm in AA. What are these people doing? Because now I'm starting to get sober. There's a lot more to that. But really my message tonight is really not about it, because you all experienced your own nightmare with booze, right? My message tonight really is about my alcoholism started when the bottle ended, because it was my solution. It wasn't my problem. I started drinking at 11 years old. 11. I didn't know what it was like to be a young adult, nothing, an adolescent, nothing, a teenager, nothing. I didn't know. I woke up, I was 27. And now I have to act 27 and be 27, but I'm still 11 on the inside. And they're telling me, Lisa, you need to get a sponsor. You need to do these things. You need to go to meetings. You need to blah, blah, blah. You need to blah, blah, blah. And you got to do all these things. And I was like, yeah, I'm just, hang on a minute. I'm not drinking, right? So that's just got to be enough. And then I'm sober. I'm 6 months sober. I'm a year sober, right? And I'm going to pig roasts. And I'm going to ski trips. And I'm doing white water rafting. And I'm going to all these AA events. And I'm starting now, I'm chairing meetings, and I'm doing this, and I'm doing that, and I'm calling my sponsor when she's not home. And I'm making sure that I don't do any of that, right? And she's, and people are telling me to read the book, and I'm like, okay, you know, all this, and people are saying to me, what step one you're on? And I'm lying to them. I'm like, oh, step two. And then I notice, like, I had a gym, well, the first thing I got was a gym membership. And I dyed my hair blonde and got some cowboy boots and, got a tanning membership. Anybody can relate to that, right? So 16 months, I'm looking good. I'm smelling good. My hair's a different color. I'm doing, 675 crunches a day. And I'm just, I'm at it, right? I'm about 16 months sober. Now, my sponsor the entire time is like, you got to get into the book, Lisa. You got to get into the book. I'm like, yeah, I know. So one day I land up at a meeting at the South Philly Group on Moy Mensing Avenue, and I walk in, and there he is. You know who he is. You've had a couple of them. Or there she is, right? There he is. And I'm like, oh, my God, I've got to, sit next to him. So I maneuver myself, and I sit there, and I said, hi. I introduce myself. And he said, what step are you on? And I was like, oh, what step are you on? He's like, oh, I'm on step four. I'm like, me too. I'm on step four too. Thank God for Kathy Hines. God bless her soul. She was my first sponsor for my first 5 years. So as we got into the car, I was like, Kat, come on. We got to get on these steps right away. I got to get up to step four because Joey Bada Bing over here, he's on step four. I got to catch up. Hurry up. What do we got to do? So she took anything she got. She's like, okay, fine. Come on. Let's get to it. And I was like, all right, what else do I need to do? And yeah, and he deserved it, and he deserved it. And this is how I did my steps, right? And it was only, I wasn't capable of, like, really, honestly, was not capable of looking at myself with a clear view of who and what I was, because I had no idea who I was. I was 11 when I picked up a drink. I was completely out of my element being sober. All I know is that everything hurt. Now, if you would have taken me to a doctor and I would sat down, doc, everything hurts. Well, I don't know why. I feel sick. Why? I don't know why. I don't feel like I fit in. Why? I don't know why. I don't like myself. Why? I don't know why. Why are you suffering? I don't know why. But I'm suffering. Now I'm 16, 18 months sober. And that hole in my soul is becoming wider, wider, and wider. And it's becoming more open. And my disease, I don't know this at the time, but my disease has now gone underground. And it's showing up like whack-a-mole. It's showing up in all these different areas. It's showing up. I go to a meeting. I'm in a meeting, and I'm like, oh, there's Joey, and there's Johnny, and there's Jimmy, and there's Jack. I got to get out of here. I got to get out. There's like four guys that I've been intimate with in this meeting. It was at 18 months over, I go home, and I'm like, Kathy, Joey and Johnny and Jimmy and Jack and blah, blah, blah. And she said, Lisa, this is what she said to me. She said, will you do me a favor? Will you go and look at, this is when phones had cords. She said, Lisa, I want you to take the phone and go in and look in the mirror. And I was like, did you just hear what I said? She said, just do what I tell you to do. And I went and I looked in the mirror, and there I was. My boobs were all hyped up. I'm wearing the Daisy Duke shorts, and I'm all tan. I'm like, is it gonna hardly breathe? And she said, Lisa, you don't have to do that anymore. We love you exactly the way you are. You don't have to do that anymore. You don't have to sleep around anymore. You don't have to prove to anyone. You don't have to wear that shit anymore. You know, excuse my language. You don't have to do any of that anymore. You can just be you in AA, and we'll love you exactly the way you are. And I felt in my knees. And I didn't know what was happening, but I was having a spiritual experience. I thought, nobody has ever said anything like that to me before. No one. I just told her I slept with four men, and she's like, it's okay. Listen, this is what she said. You don't have to do it anymore. Now, why didn't I think of that? I didn't think, like, it was just, it takes a long time to get sober, folks. So if you're here, right, this gentleman with 15 days, I'm so glad you're here. This is the only place in the world, right, where you get a prize for burning down your life. Right? That we applaud you because you just burnt your life down. We're like, woo, we did it, yes! I welcome you, and I hope that you stay, and I hope because there's so much more. So there I am in my skivvies, looking in the mirror, and Kathy tells me this, and I fall to my knees, and I say, God, please show me, like, what am I doing here? And I started to get sober, little by little by. But it's interesting about the human ego and what it can do, because the moment, right, that I started going down the path of the spiritual experience and started to feel the God of my understanding, and I started to feel this hole in my soul started to close up, guess what I found? I found ambition and money. I was like, oh, where have you been all my life? That's what I need. And I started going down that road. So now I'm feeling better about myself. Now I got my business suit on. Right? And I'm like, oh, you know, I gotta work now, and I gotta be somebody, and I gotta do something, and I gotta be somebody, and I gotta look good, and I gotta... Alcoholism is not so much in the bottle, but it is in your mind. We have a mental illness coupled with a physical allergy. That's what I have. It doesn't have anything to do with the vodka, the gin, or the beer, or the Sambuca. It doesn't have anything to do with that. See, those things settled my mind, my feeling apart from, my apartness, my separation from you. So I found something else. So now, right, I love what Cliff said last night. He was trying to make a name for himself in an anonymous program. Right, my sponsor said to me, "What are you trying to be popular in the sanitarium? You know we're all wearing paper slippers, right, Lise? And you're trying to be like top paper slipper person? Like, what's the matter with you?" I was like, "Oh, I never thought of it like that." But that's truly the human ego. And now I'm going down the path of money, power, and prestige. And guess what? You put an alcoholic to a task, once this person and everyone in here makes up their mind to do something, watch out. It's already done. So I go after this with a ferociousness. And I open up my own jewelry store in Philadelphia on Jewelers Row, a retail store. And I get people to hand me hundreds of thousands of dollars on consignment. How I got them, they knew my background. How I got them, I just accomplished a lot, four, five, 6 years sober. And now, you know, the money's coming in. I'm building a custom house in New Jersey, right? Oh, and by the way, I got married. I'm sure you're shocked. Because I was 30. That's the reason I'm like, I'm 30 now. Okay, you'll do. You ready? Come on, we're going to walk down the aisle. I swear to God. Now, Now, let me tell you how delusional you can be. There's a line in the big book, and it says something to the fact of, aren't we under the delusion that we can wrest happiness out of this life if we only manage well? I should have had that tattooed on my head. Because I was going to manage my life well. I was going to do it. I was going to manage it well. I was going to become successful. I was going to be the AA guru. Right? Cliff said that he was the sheriff. I was the dictator. I was walking around with my book in my hand. You know, I was one of these people. Right? 6-7 years sober. I look good. You know, I'm only shopping at Neiman Marcus. I'm only wearing labels. They're moving the car door. You know, as I'm driving the car out of the showroom floor, I got a custom house built, all of it, right? I have a husband. I have a boyfriend. I'm living life. All is well. And I'm about 5 or 6 years sober. And I am just hustling and making money and blah, 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 right? And all of a sudden it starts again. I start to notice that I'm starting to have the same exact feeling that I had when I had 18 months. It's starting to open again. See, the truth of the matter is I don't have a God. But I'm telling you I have a God. Matter of fact, I'm sponsoring the women, telling them, you better get a God. Gotta turn that over. But I don't have a God. Self will run riot. See, lack of power is my dilemma. I mean, it's so plain. They say it, these little plain sayings in the book. They're so simple. Yet it took me years to understand lack of power is my dilemma. It took me years to really understand what that meant. I had to find another power, or I'm going to be chronically irritable, restless, and discontent. And unless I can somehow get the ease and comfort somewhere else, I'm destined to drink again. It says it in black and white, but I'm like, yeah, no. I think, like, if I repeat it or I'm a mess. But I can't tell anybody. Oh, I forgot about that. Can't tell anybody I'm a mess. And I can't tell anybody that I don't feel good. Because if you look at me, now I'm like 6-7 years sober. If you look at me, right, I'm wearing designer clothes. I came from the woods. I got in a fancy car and I'm in the house. And my business is doing great. And I got like 8 little minions behind me. And everybody loves me. And I'm like, whoop, whoop, whoop. You know, and I walk into an AA meeting and I'm doing the Miss America wave. I'm like... And that's who I've become. And I don't know. See, I'm so used to suffering that I know that I'm suffering, but I don't really know how bad. It's like having a stone in your shoe for 20 years. You just get so used to it. You don't even realize how bad you got used to it until you remove the stone. Then you walk around and you're like, oh my God, I've been walking around like this for this long. So I'm about 6 or 7 years sober. And here was my spiritual experience. I was in my jewelry store and we had the Orkin or the Terminex guy come in every month to do our bug spray. And I always was fond of him. I always thought he was just so cute. And he came in one day to go downstairs to do the, and I was like, you know what, I'm going to follow him downstairs. And as I'm walking downstairs, I'm holding on to the guardrail and I start to well up and I'm like, something's wrong with me. I'm not right. I feel ugly inside. And no matter what anybody gives to me, says to me, what I accomplish, what I get, what I do, nothing is satiating me. What the hell is wrong with me? Now, I'm in therapy at this time because I'm such a mess. Because there's got to be, like, for me, there's got to be this grand problem. Like, I got to be schizophrenic. Okay? I got to be something. I got to be bipolar something. 2, 5, 8, anything. It can't just be plain alcoholism. It can't. People are saying to me, Lisa, you're alcoholic. I'm like, yeah, I know. But I didn't know what that meant to be alcoholic. So I stop in the middle of my tracks. I make a U-turn. I go back upstairs. I call my sponsor. And I say, something ain't right. I'm not feeling right. But I don't know what it is. So to make a long story short, I moved to Jersey, right? So I let go of Kathy. I was trying to find a sponsor in New Jersey. I was going to this one meeting called at the Kiss Club in Belmar. So I go that particular night. I leave and I go to a meeting. And I meet this woman named Sally. She's celebrating 25 years. And after she gets done celebrating, I said, can I talk to you afterwards? I get her, you know, outside. And I say, listen, Sal, what I'm about to tell you is it could possibly ruin my marriage. She was like, stop right there. I could care less. Lisa, I already know. What? And I was like, how does she know? She said, listen, I've been watching you come here. She goes, you know what I call you? She's not out loud, but in my head, you know what I... She goes, because I am you. I call you the busy. You're busy. Busy doing things. Busy getting things. Busy accomplishing things. You're busy, busy, busy. She said, if you want the help, then meet me at my house tomorrow on Lake Avenue at 12 o'clock. Be there. And I'm gonna go over the book with you. And I thought, I was so desperate at the time, I thought, okay. And I remember keep in mind, I'm almost 8 years sober. I drive up to her house the next day at 12 o'clock. And I look at her house and I thought, what is a little place that she, what's she gonna teach me? I mean, I'm so full of myself. I'm so arrogant. I'm so ignorant to my own illness. I have no idea what I'm doing. I get out of the car. I go into her house. She says to me, Lisa, go inside the bathroom and get me a hand mirror. And I'm thinking to myself, like, she couldn't do that before I got here. Like, this was my thinking mind. So I go in, I get the mirror. I sit it down on the table, and she goes, there's your problem. Look in the mirror. She goes, listen, you've been sober, what, 8 years or so, 7, 8 years? I said, yeah. She goes, you don't have a drinking problem anymore. You got a thinking problem, you got a you problem, you got an alcoholism, not wasm. Now, when I heard that, I heard alcoholism, not wasm, 1,000 times, and in my head, I thought, refrigerator magnet. Like, it's so alcoholism and not wasm. 1,000 times. And let me tell you something, alcoholism, not goddamn wasm. I didn't understand that until I had 8 years clean sober. And she said to me, I'm going to go through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous with you. You got to be here every Tuesday night at 6:30. It's a 12 weeks I do this with my girls. You get one time that you don't show up. You get one cancellation. If you cancel more than that, you're out. And I was just desperate enough to say okay to that. And just before I was like, okay, I'll do this. She goes, no. I don't want to hear your answer now. I want you to think about it. You jump into everything. So you don't have, you wouldn't know a pause button if it's bit you in the bum. You don't know nothing about pausing. You don't know nothing about restraint. You don't know nothing about self-control. You don't know nothing about that. I want you to think about what I'm trying to say to you and then get back to me with an answer. Can you do that? I was like, I can do that. Because prior to that, that week before, I was driving over the Benjamin Franklin Bridge thinking, how can I get this airbag out of my car? Because I don't want to drink per se, but I'm starting to get like suicidal thoughts now. Like I don't really want to live anymore. Like, just like pass the salt. I was like, you know what? I don't think I want to live anymore. It wasn't like, I don't want to live anymore. It wasn't like that for me. I was like, you know what? I'm out. I had enough of this world. I seen what I wanted to see. I'm good. I got sober. It didn't really work out for me. I don't really want to go back to living in the woods and drinking, and that was a goddamn mess. But I don't really want to live. Alcoholism is a deadly, progressive illness. And it's just like any other illness. It is out to kill its host. Just like any other illness. But I thought it was like a character defect. I thought it was like a problem that I was going to get a hold of. This is not a program. This is not an academic program. This is not a self-help program. Because if this was a self-help program, we would be up here telling you how to help yourself. That's not our message. Our message is this. Step away from your life. You don't know how to run it. You think you do, but you don't. Because every time you get in the driver's seat of your life, you just start having suicidal ideations. You have to find a power greater than yourself to hand your life over to. When you take that third step and you say, God, I am now ready and willing. Please. Please. He took you seriously. He wants you to turn your life over to Him and trust Him with it.
Wow, my God, that's a lot. That's a tall order.
Mm-hmm. He doesn't want me just to give Him my alcoholism. No. He wants me to give Him all of me. That means my romance and finance. That means my job. That means my everything. I turn my life over to a God that I understand at that time. Now, while I'm going over to Sally's house and she's changing my life, you know, I think, you know, she's like, these people should be on my payroll or something. You really don't understand the importance of sponsorship or what sponsors really do for you until later on. I mean, this woman was so kind and loving to me, and she would told me how it was. And every single Tuesday night, she'd sit down, she'd say, break open the book and read me the paragraph, please. And she gave me a specific paragraph. It was for me. I'd like to just read it. It's not long. It's the second paragraph in step four of page 4. And it goes like this. Yet these instincts that are so necessary for our existence often far exceed their proper functions. Powerfully, blindly, and sometimes subtly, they drive us, they dominate us, and insist upon ruling our lives. Our desire for sex, the material and emotional security, and for an important place in society often tyrannize us. And when thus out of joint, man's natural desires cause him great trouble, practically all the trouble there is. No human being, however good, is exempt from these troubles. Nearly every serious emotional problem can be seen as a case of misdirected instinct. And I would read the paragraph, and then she would reply, bingo! And we get started. Because I was one big case of misdirected instinct. But here's the good news. Through all of this pain, and all of me trying to figure it out, and me trying to do it, and me trying to run it, and me trying to do this and that, I wasn't drinking. That's the key. You don't drink, you don't think, and you make a meeting. And how could we not think that the basics and getting back, that's all there is. When Cliff said that, like, that's all there is.
is the basics. There's nothing more. In our convoluted mind, we think that we're like a, you know, guru. Like, I know the... No! It's just the basics. This is a very simple program for very complex people. And as she took me through the book, I went through the book really at 8 years sober for the first time. And I had a spiritual experience with Sally. And I started to understand the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can't believe that I stayed sober. If it wasn't for her, it was just a matter of time. Because I was on my way of burning my life to the ground sober. I was not to be trusted. I was insecure. I was a liar. I was a cheater. Now, when I tell you that I didn't know that I was those things, you could have hooked me up to a lie detector test and I would have passed. The delusion that we can wrest happiness out of this life if we only manage well. That was me. I just wanted my life. I drank. I was living in the woods. I was a mess at 11 years old. Blah, 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 blah. I just want my life back. Give me my life back. Okay, here you go. I made a mess of it. I was a sober mess. But I was sober. And I didn't want to drink because I knew where that would get me. But I didn't want to live. And dying was better than the pain that I was feeling because I was just so sick of the internal struggle and the pain of alcoholism. Because now I got nothing to dilute it with. I don't got any anesthesia. I'm dealing with this brain, no booze. Ho ho! Crazy land. Preaching to people how to do it and send it and go it and be it and all that kind of stuff. There's a wonderful speaker. His name is Sammy Beach. Loved him dearly. I used to listen to him all the time. And he always talked about the second surrender. Now, I didn't know that I was going through a second surrender. But there is a second surrender in this program. The first time, you surrender the booze. And the second time, you surrender your will. And you will have to be almost broken harder the second time than the first. You have to be convinced that you don't know how to run your life. And you also have to be convinced that booze is not the answer. You have to turn your life over to a God that you can't see, you can't feel, you can't touch. But once you do, voila, the magic happens. Because now that you have faith and trust, it says in our literature that we can have a working faith and still keep God out of our lives. But if we have faith and trust, now we're getting somewhere. Because our worry about our lives goes from here to like here. Because we know God has us. And that we're exactly where we're supposed to be. And divine timing is what now we live by. And the ego has been crushed. Because now you thought you were somebody and you found out again, you nobody. You are nobody again. And wow, isn't that a wonderful news? Because your arrogance and your ignorance gets crushed again. And you become what they call in the step book, right-sized. And then you can walk shoulder to shoulder with your alcoholic people, your alcoholic network, your alcoholic tribe, because you are no longer above them nor below them. For you now realize what the word humility is, that you are just like them. That even when you're sober, you're making mistakes, you're cheating, you're stealing, you're this. I was just telling Chris, I had a year sober. I was in CVS at 9 months sober, stealing rubber bands for the thrill of it. committing a felony for the $2 rubber bands, for the thrill, stealing the 5-hour energy drinks, like, with a pocket full of money. If that's not insanity, because I love this feeling.
You know all when I'm talking about this one.
Like I'm getting away with something. It takes a long time to get sober. It takes even longer to get emotionally sober. And it takes even longer to get humbled by life and your ego. We'll just keep on stomping on you until you start paying attention. Because God keeps on saying, it's like being, you ever have a 2-year-old with like a broken truck? And you go up to the 2-year-old, and you're like, here, honey, let me, I got it, I'm going to put the wheel back. And I'm like, no, let me, no, no, let me, no, let me. Until the child is laying on the floor and cried himself to sleep, does the parent go over quietly to repair the truck. That's how God worked in my life. I had to be screaming, crying, and having a temper tantrum on the rug, and then he quietly put Sally in my life. There's going to be a sponsor in your life that's going to change your life completely. He's going to treat you with respect and slap you in the face at the same time. They're going to hug you, slap you. They're going to hug you and love you and slap you. It is such a beautiful balance. They're going to love you and they're going to tell you the truth at the same time. You know, a therapist will say to you, well, how does that make you feel? My therapist says, how does that make you feel, Lisa? And my sponsor would say, darling, I don't care how you feel. Do it anyway. But I'm scared. Do it scared. I don't know how to do it. You'll find a way. You'll find a way. I'm here to support you. I'm here to love you while you find a way. But I'm not here to do it for you. Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't even describe what it's like to be called up from Karen and you good people and say, hey, listen, can you come out to Marietta, Georgia and speak for us? Because that's included in the ticket. That's included in the ticket. And I get to meet all you and be with you and eat with you and laugh with you. And I'm truly humbled to be in your presence. Thank you. My name's Lisa Lowe, and I'm an alcoholic.